I'm going to start this course with a general introduction, and that's what today will be. So normally this is going to be mostly on the blackboard, but with some slides. There's a fair bit of experimental data that I could sit here and try and draw, but it's just better to show it to you. So that's why we'll use this throughout the 3 weeks. But today, like I said, it's going to be an introduction. Don't fret if you don't follow everything here. I'm trying to give you flavor for what we're going to learn about and why we might be interested in learning further about condensed matter. It's again an unusual course. We have 3 weeks, 15 lectures, and it's to give you an introduction to condensed matter that's normally done at University of Alberta in two courses, you know, with 35 hours in each course. So I will have picked and chosen certain topics. My own area of research is, well, it does a variety of things, but focuses on superconductivity. So that's what I'll talk a little bit about today and what will show up at towards the end of the course. So that's an example of a mini-body theory, which is sort of towards a more complicated end of the spectrum. Okay, so let's begin. Let me, one more thing, just feel free to interrupt anytime you have questions. There's a tendency, not just in our field, in any field, I think, to sort of lapse into jargon. I'll say something that I think is everybody knows about, but everybody doesn't know about it, so if you don't hesitate to interrupt. So I like to start by putting condensed matter in context of everything else. This is sort of covers all of physics. This is a classification scheme that I think is no longer being used as of a year or two ago. But this course in condensed matter covers these two parts of this classification. Except that when you go in more deeply into those, you know, subsection 60 and 70, those are further broken down into a number of subtopics. There's superconductivity, for example, lattice dynamics we'll cover, and as I said, superconductivity in earnest. But you can go further within superconductivity, and there's actually two pages of this. So you just have to appreciate that we're not, there's going to be a lot left out. I'm not going to pretend to be comprehensive in this course, even back at this level. We're going to leave whole parts of this structure of condensed matter out and necessarily focus on a few aspects that partly are fundamental, that will help you delve into these topics if you wish further, and partly are a reflection of my own tastes. So this is an outline. I don't know if you've seen this for this course. As far as I'm, so I've prepared lectures based a bit on this outline, but you know, there are certain ones of these lectures that I will happily congratulate myself if I actually get through the material I've prepared. I likely won't, or I might spill over to another lecture and then some of this stuff will shift around. But this is roughly the idea of what we're going to cover in this course. So let me begin first with the electromagnetic spectrum. The real purpose of introducing this is for units. Okay, so in condensed matter, there are a variety of units in use, millielectron volts and Kelvin tend to be interchangeable. So we like to, and this is important because of thermodynamic properties. So often energies will be expressed in terms of Kelvin, so you get a flavor for, okay, if you do this experiment at room temperature, about 300 degrees Kelvin, then will you have the resolution to see what you're looking for. and how far down in temperature do you have to go? Other units in the far infrared community, for example, or neutron scattering, use terahertz, and these are the conversions. Some of the infrared people use inverse centimeters, and even these funny units are sometimes used, but I won't be using those. And again, to put things in context over here, this is wavelength in meters, so these are length scales. The only thing I would say here is that down in this regime, so 10 to the minus 10 meters is one angstrom. So I will use angstroms, even though they're not SI. And as you can see, I'm using electron volts instead of joules because I don't want to carry around lots of exponents. And in any event, that's what you're going to see in the literature. You're going to see things in units of electron volts and millielectron volts. So here they are sort of on a scale that you can visualize. Kelvin is about a tenth of a millielectron volt. Okay, if we start with the periodic table and just ask, okay, what does nature tend to do? You can see that there are a lot of metals. So these are just elemental compounds. Of course, you can do all sorts of chemistry with these elements and form a gazillion different types of materials, but now we're just talking about the elemental solids. And what you see is the majority of them are metals. There are insulators over here, nonmetals, and what are called semi-metals. That's what the periodic table gives us. This is not so visible, but this is what you get from Ashcroft and Merman in the inside the front cover. I like this one because you get the valences. So you know the fact that helium is sort of got a electron structure that is 1s up, 1s down, so two of them. Neon is the same sort of thing. And then once you get further down, like argon, they start off with neon, and then they just show you what's left, which is a closed shell. So you can look at these things and see what's missing. For example, in oxygen, it's 2p4, and so there are two electrons that are needed to form a closed shell, and those two electrons are the type N equals 2 and L equals 1, or p-type electrons. And so you may or may not know that oxygen, when placed in a solid, always tends to want to be O double minus, okay? Because it wants to grab two electrons and form this closed shell structure. So that's in Ashcroft and Merman. If you look at an old article now by Ashcroft, this was in News and Views in Nature, and it dealt specifically with superconductivity. He showed a periodic table that was a bit more specific than the previous one. This breaks down the elements into those that are actually superconducting. So there's a lot of metallic compounds, or not compounds, elemental solids that become superconducting. And you notice the ones in orange only become, I don't know if there's another, no, I guess the legend isn't on here, but the orange, ones in orange only become superconducting when you apply pressure. Okay, so you know, oxygen and sulfur become superconductors, but you have to apply pressure. Okay, and those are within the last 15 years that those have been discovered. The ones in pink here are normally superconducting at atmospheric pressures. If you look at this a little, you realize, well, actually one of the best metals we have is, for example, copper. Even silver and gold are pretty good metals. They don't superconduct. So this is something we've known since the beginning, really. Contrary to what you might think, the best metals don't superconduct. And superconductivity has zero resistivity, perfect conduction, but it requires a phase transition. and we'll learn more about that later on. This is a more sort of modern timeline showing you some of the trends, especially with this discovery in 1986 of high temperature superconductivity, where the critical temperature at which this phase transition occurs really went through the roof. The big deal really with these compounds was it went above liquid nitrogen temperatures. So most superconductors, all the superconductors right now that are used, for example, in hospitals for MRI magnets, use helium cooling technology, okay, down at 4 degrees Kelvin, and that makes it fairly expensive. If we could get away with just using liquid nitrogen, everything would be a lot cheaper to cool. So this is a significant breakthrough. The applications operating up in this temperature range haven't come yet, but hopefully they're down the road. What you have to realize is interspersed with all this is a whole family of different types of superconductors. Yes?
Theory not understood means that the two types of superconductors have different theories?
Very, very good question. So I guess I put that I have a version of this slide that when I click again, not only does it say theory not understood here and theory well understood here, but theory well understood here appears with a question mark, which didn't happen here. Let me zip ahead to this issue from last year that we put together. And this, what we did here, so together with two other people, I edited this special issue, and we invited about 32 experts around the world to write review articles on the materials. Okay, so we basically forbade theorists from writing here, except we violated that because we needed to write one of the articles because nobody would come forward to write it. These are all people who prepare these materials. Every one of these represents a family of different superconductors. So you're not familiar, for example, I don't know how many of you have heard of where are those? I'm looking for heavy fermions, right here. You know, heavy fermions are these metals that have electrons with an effective mass that are huge. They're about 1,000 times. And they superconduct at low temperatures. The fullerenes are these carbon-based materials that form these buckyballs. When you dope those superconduct. The cuprates are these high-temperature superconductors. Organic materials are these quasi-one-dimensional or quasi-two-dimensional materials made with organic material, carbon. I've got them listed down here, and there's a, you know, for a while people were bragging that the rate of increase of critical temperature was the highest. Okay, so, and we divided these into three categories. These are our so-called conventional superconductors. These are possibly conventional superconductors, and these are undetermined in terms of what the mechanism is. And so, one of the reasons for bringing this, for doing this special issue, was to highlight the fact that this sort of looks a little ridiculous, right? We have roughly 32 different types of superconductors, and for many of them, people think the reason why they superconduct is different. So the theory is not understood, to answer your question. For these, people think they're understood for these ones, but that's why I put a question mark sometimes in that slide. Because this, pardon?
These 32 different mechanisms.
Yeah. So for any of you that have studied the history of particle physics, you know that in the late 50s, there was a new discovery of a fundamental particle every year, roughly, right? And at some point, people started thinking, this doesn't seem quite right. And that spurred people like Gell-Mann and others to develop the quark model. And that kind of brought some unity. My own gut feeling is that's what's needed here. Okay, so there's certainly, you know, nobody argues with the fact that there's no consensus on what the understanding of these class of materials and some of the ones listed down here are, but most people in the world think that the theory for these materials is understood. Okay, my thesis is on the theory that explains these materials. I'm not so sure anymore. Okay. And that's just another timeline. Okay, so let me just say a little more about the history of superconductivity. It was discovered in 1911. It's attributed to Kamerlingh Onnes, as you'll see in a second. It was actually his student, Gilles Holst, that discovered it in the lab, and then Kamerlingh Onnes came down the next morning and took the photographs. And in those days, you guys should feel very lucky, because in those days, the supervisor would publish the paper without the student's name on it. The supervisor would get the Nobel Prize without the student, and on it would go. And by the way, Kamerlingh Onnes is famous, or maybe infamous, for several other things. So, and especially pertinent to what you do here, or people do here at Perimeter. In 1901, so Albert Einstein applied for a student fellowship with Kamerlingh Onnes. Kamerlingh Onnes didn't respond to his letter, so Einstein went off and did other things, probably for the better. And in 1896, Peter Zeeman was a student of Kamerlingh Onnes and kept wanting to work on something which eventually was called the Zeeman effect. And the story, I've read it in at least one book, and I just checked Wikipedia, and the Wikipedia says the same thing, except it says it's unverified. The story is that he went away on a trip, and of course Zeeman took the opportunity to go back to his experiments, and then Onnes fired him when he got back and realized he hadn't been doing what he had been told. Anyway, Zeeman won a Nobel Prize for that stuff that he got fired for, at least allegedly fired for. So it was a difficult place. You should realize that when they did this experiment, what Kamerlingh Onnes was looking for, and this is why they used mercury. In fact, it was sort of a waste of time in hindsight. Mercury is a metal, is a liquid, until very low temperatures, so you can distill it. Why do you want to distill it? Because you want to make it as pure as possible. Okay, because what they were interested in was this. There were two competing theories that the resistivity of a metal, if you could get rid of all the impurities, so the intrinsic resistivity would either go to zero, so it would become a perfect conductor, or it would go to infinity. And it was Lord Kelvin at the time who felt it would go to infinity. Why would it go to infinity? I guess you can appreciate, I don't know if you guys learned Bloch's theorem a little bit. Okay, so that tells you that even though there's a periodic array of ions, it might as well be free space as far as conductivity is concerned. The electrons don't even notice the ions, so the conductivity will be perfect if there are no impurities. So that's sort of the notion behind, this is of course before Bloch, but that was the notion behind this resistivity going to zero. The notion behind the resistivity going to infinity is, well, what happens when you take water and you cool it below 0 degrees Celsius? Well, it freezes. What does that mean? It means that the ions in water form a solid. They freeze into position. They can no longer move around. Okay. Lord Kelvin felt the same thing would happen to electrons. If you cooled, so you were down in the regime where the thing was a solid, that means the ions, the heavy guys, have already frozen. But his theory was that if you kept going down lower in temperature, the same thing would happen to the electrons. They would freeze into place. And therefore, you'd have an insulator. And the resistivity would go to infinity. And that was a correct notion in the sense that the guy, Wigner, known for group theory and for developing nuclear reactors after World War II, had also much later hypothesized what's now known as a Wigner crystallization, and it's been observed in some materials. So that's what they were looking for. Instead, they found this abrupt decrease to zero at about 4 degrees Kelvin. So that was a complete surprise. And as I mentioned, it was Gilles Holst, who later, you know, he became famous in his own right. He was founding director of Philips Labs, and he's got lectures named after him and so on. But he's not as well known as Kamerlingh Ohms. Same thing happened in 1932, I believe, with the discovery of the Meissner effect, which I'll call Meissner-Ochsenfeld, because again, there was I forget if he was a student or a research assistant, that is also responsible for this discovery. So I'll call it the Meissner-Ochsenfeld effect. This is very, very important, and it says that a superconductor is not just a perfect conductor. So that original idea that, okay, as you cool, you'll get a zero resistivity if the thing were pure, that's a perfect conductor. And that's, maybe that exists, but that's not what superconductivity is. Because superconductivity is not only a perfect conductor, but it's also a perfect diamagnet. So it expels magnetic fields. And it's important to distinguish between expulsion and exclusion. So this is a case where you've got the temperature is above the critical temperature. There's no field here. Now you put in a field, okay, because the temperature is above the critical temperature, the field will penetrate the material. Now you lower the temperature below that critical temperature TC, and you'll actually push out the magnetic field. So you've all seen these pictures of magnets floating above a superconductor. Okay, if you just see that picture, that's not evidence for superconductivity. What you need to see is the video where the magnet is sitting on the superconductor, and then you cool the sample, and all of a sudden the magnet pops up. Because now the flux is being excluded from the superconductor, and that's what's pushing the magnet up. Okay, the flux exclusion, which I think is this one, where you, you cool to low temperatures, and then you put in a field, and it doesn't penetrate the material, that's flux exclusion. And that's Lenz's law. That'll happen in a non-superconductor that happens to be a perfect conductor. Okay, so this is the key experiment here. Yeah. And what's happened in recent years, so this is a phase diagram for the high temperature superconducting cuprates. So let me just back up for a second. And this is typically what you did, you took a compound, it didn't have to be an elemental compound like mercury, it could be something even more complicated, and you produced it, and then you lowered the temperature, and you saw it superconduct, and you measured the properties. What's happened in latter years is you want to put that in context. So that figure I just showed you, for example, says suppose you prepared a compound that had this amount of doping, and now you just lower the temperature, and you'd see it superconduct here, and boom, that's it. But what's of more interest now is, okay, where does this compound sit in the grand scheme of things? In other words, as a function of doping, what's doping? Doping means that you take a material that's stoichiometric, typically. So in this case, this is generic, but suppose it's lanthanum 2 Cu(O)4. So that's stoichiometric because there are integers everywhere here. But now you dope it. What does dope it mean? It means that you take a certain number of the lanthanum ions and you replace them with strontium. So, and this X is connected to that P. Why is this doping with holes? Because we have to race back to one of these periodic tables, and there's lanthanum, okay, and because it's 3 over, it likes to be 3+. But strontium likes to be 2+. So whereas lanthanum gives up 3 of its electrons to the surrounding material, strontium likes to give up 2 of them. So in doing this substitution, you're actually making fewer electrons available to the rest of the material that presumably is doing the conducting, and fewer electrons we translate into more holes. Everybody familiar with the idea of electrons versus holes? Is that just the absence of electrons? Okay. So why this is provokes so much interest is because you have all sorts of stuff going on here. In the stoichiometric compound, you have an antiferromagnetic insulator that then becomes a metal at some point and then becomes a superconductor when you lower the temperature enough. In between, though, it's not actually a regular metal. And a lot of the interest has been worrying about what this pseudogap thing is all about. FL over here stands for Fermi liquid. That's your sort of regular metal that we'll learn more about later on. Okay, so that's
maybe shortly what the gap.
The pseudo gap?
Yeah.
This just means that a superconductor is characterized most of the time by having a gap in the energy spectrum. So instead of having a continuum of energies, it's got a gap. The pseudo gap means that in the normal state, when it's not a superconductor, it looks like it's trying to form a gap, but it's not quite got there. So there seem to be energy states near the Fermi level. Are everybody familiar with what the Fermi level is? I will come to it again, but there seem to be energy states that are missing, that have been pushed somewhere else to higher energy or lower energy.
So it's basically a metal state?
Yes.
Which has some which is relative to superconductor.
Good question. Yes and no. Because an antiferromagnetic state also has a gap associated with it. And this pseudo gap here is attributed by some to the gap nature associated with the antiferromagnet, and it's attributed by some to the gap nature associated with the superconductor. So that's an open question. But that's getting way ahead of ourselves in this matter. Let me back up. So I should have started here probably with the basics. First, let me emphasize that unlike other fields, we know what this theory is about. Okay, we know the Hamiltonian, we know basically there are electrons that move around. This is the kinetic energy of electrons. There are ions that could move around. That's what this is. And then there are Coulomb interactions between all of those particles. And aside from relativistic effects, and there are relativistic effects in solids, especially spin orbit coupling. Okay, we're essentially not going to get into spin orbit coupling, but that's very topical these days because of so-called topological insulators, and I think some of that work is being done here. And that's a relativistic effect ultimately, but it shows up in quite a big way in solids down at low energies. So we know the Hamiltonian. These two guys wrote an article 16 years ago now, sort of an overview of the field, and it was actually sort of had the tone of complaining, I think, to the particle physics community that we in condensed matter actually do things that are important as well. Basically saying, okay, we know the theory, but it doesn't tell us anything. I mean, we'll learn, you maybe already learned a bit about phonons. We'll learn about phonons. You don't see any phonons here. Well, we know the Hamiltonian, but it takes a lot of effort to figure out, oh, there are these things maybe called phonons, which are possible excitations in the system. And there are many more examples, like the fact that fractional charged particles might emerge from this is simply not obvious. And that's what condensed matter is about. We know what we're starting with, but it's a way of characterizing the excitations in a solid that concerns us. Okay, and there was this very influential article back in 1972 where this was really pointed out. Okay, what we use a lot is something called Fermi liquid theory, which this is maybe a very bad characterization, but it basically says that you can not worry that much about all the interactions, that they get renormalized, if you like, to something that is relatively harmless, and so we can understand metallic behavior fairly well just thinking about essentially non-interacting particles, non-interacting electrons. And that's the premise for conventional superconductivity, and I view that as a big rug because that's exactly what we're starting to question about a lot of these newer families of superconductors, and not just superconductors, but other materials as well that are doing strange things. And we're wondering, well, maybe we shouldn't be so quick to sort of adopt a Fermi liquid approach. So the band theory of metals, which I think you've had some introduction to, and we're going to do some more in the next few days, basically, there's two starting points. Let's leave that till later. There's basically you start with one atom, and then for one atom you've solved the problem. It's the hydrogen atom problem, and you know there are these levels, n equals one, the s states, n equals two, 2s, and so on. And the question is, what happens if you bring? Well, you tell me. What happens if you bring two of these atoms close to one another? Have you ever done a double well potential problem? So what happens to the energy levels? Yeah, they split. They split ever so slightly. So these become two, right? And so what happens if you bring 10 to the 23rd? 10 to the 23rd, because that's Avogadro's number. What happens if you bring 10 to the 23rd of these atoms together? Well, they split in roughly 10 to the 23rd levels. And I got tired of drawing lines, so what people normally do is they draw a band, because there's 10 to the 23rd lines in that band. And that, you know, if you have the patience to draw it, it'll look like a shaded in band, so you might as well draw that from the beginning. So that's what happens when you bring all these atoms and form a solid. Now, it's not true that there's 10 to the 23rd atoms clustering around the one in the middle, but the one in the middle is connected to the ones to the side, and those to the side are connected to the other ones, and they're all connected to one another. And so you get this formation of bands. And so at the end of the day, you've got bands, these shaded in blue regions, which I think you've already seen, and we'll do it again, are separated by gaps. So now, remember, you started off with levels that were separated by huge gaps, right? This is the difference between the 1s level and the 2s and 2p levels in hydrogen. So 13.6 electron volts, and then 13.6 divided by 4 electron volts. So that's a big, so the gap's actually smaller, but it's still a gap. And what does that mean? That means that if you've got a certain number of electrons that are liberated, what does liberated mean? Well, again, you go back to the periodic table, and if you form a solid with the noble elements, they like to hang on to their electrons and nothing is liberated, and you get an insulator. But if you form it with the alkali metals, the first column, like sodium, that last electron on sodium has 11 electrons. That last electron is very loosely held, and it will tend to migrate around. So it's liberated to the solid as a whole. How many of those electrons are liberated? Well, it depends on circumstances, and for example, it depends on the ability to dope. And so you might find the Fermi level right there, and that means that all these states under the Fermi level are filled, and these ones above here are empty. Well, that's a metal, because you can apply an electric field and you can excite states, electrons that are down here, into states that are unoccupied. And then you get conduction. If you put more electrons in and you get to this point, same thing. If you find yourself in a situation where the Fermi level is here, that's no longer true, right? And now there's this gap. You can't just have a small electric field and move some of these electrons up into states over here, because that requires a big energy. And you can't get that with a small electric field. So you have an insulating state. Okay, and that's sort of the old basic understanding of metallic behavior when the Fermi level was here, and insulating behavior when the Fermi level was in one of these gaps. And what controlled where the Fermi level was how many electrons were being liberated to the material, meaning they could migrate away from the atom in which they resided when they were first introduced. And that's got a lot to do with chemistry. So if you're in one of these situations where the Fermi level is down here, then the way we understand that is through this Fermi liquid picture. But let me just draw figures representing electrons that are not interacting with one another. So it's like somebody's turned off the Coulomb interaction. And now all you have are statistics. Okay, and you can't put all the electrons in the ground state down here because you've got the Pauli exclusion principle. Electrons are fermions. So you have to, once you put two of them there, you've got to go up to the next highest states. And by the time you get around to putting something like 10 to the 23rd of these electrons in their states, you form this so-called Fermi sphere. Okay, so this Fermi sphere consists of all the states that are in this region in wave vector space that are occupied, and then all these states out here are unoccupied. Okay, and if these electrons are non-interacting, then their energies are simply given by the free electron dispersion relation. So constant energy surfaces form spheres, right? Because this is isotropic in K, so that's why this is depicting a sphere. If you plot the distribution of these things versus momentum, it's isotropic, so we only need the magnitude of the momentum, and you get this step function. If you're at finite temperatures, you get the Fermi-Dirac distribution function, I think, as you already learned in statistical mechanics. And so you get this smeared distribution. At zero temperature, it's a step, and this where this step occurs is called the Fermi surface. Okay. The alternative point of view is, forget about kinetic energy. These are electrons. They repel one another. So the last thing you want is two electrons nearby. If every one of these atoms is a sodium atom and giving up one electron, there's 10 to the 23rd electrons floating around. What's the best way you can make sure that they never sit on top of one another? Well, if you keep them frozen, keep them placed in place, and they don't move, and that's an insulating state. Okay, so on the one hand here, you've discarded thinking about the potential energy, the Coulomb repulsion. You just focused on the kinetic energy, which is this. And on the other hand, you said, forget about the kinetic energy, let's just focus on the Coulomb repulsion. Okay? And you can see, by the way, we'll learn about this in more depth later on. You can see that I've actually alternated them, spin up and spin down, and that's a cartoon of the of what the situation actually looks like, as opposed to random spins. And the reason for that will become apparent later on. And again, it was Phil Anderson who, remember when I showed you the high temperature superconducting phase diagram, which was way back here, that there was an anti-ferromagnetic insulating state here. It was Phil Anderson that said, okay, we can understand this as being a state like the one I depicted there, that insulating state. And now when we dope it, that introduces frustration, which again, we'll learn about later on. And when it's frustrated, it's not so easy to form that anti-ferromagnetic state as I've drawn here. Let me just caution you right now. This is what's referred to as a nail state, and it is a cartoon. Okay, it's not an actual eigenstate of this problem, but it's the way we understand an anti-ferromagnetic ground state. So I'm just moving through a number of topics, although I seem to migrate a lot back to superconductivity, and it's going to happen again here. But there are these famous experiments starting in the 80s, even earlier really in the 70s, where people wanted to study the two-dimensional limit. So actually, this is something Dennis worked on a lot way back. So D is the thickness of this thin film. And there's something you can call the sheet resistance, which goes like the inverse of this D. So as sheet resistance increases, you're decreasing the thickness of this film. And what people discovered is, and sort of expected, was that the critical temperature for superconductivity, so lead has a critical temperature of about 7 degrees, but as you decrease this thickness, it goes down. Okay? Which is not surprising. What was kind of nifty, though, was that if you carried out a series of these experiments with different thicknesses, so now the film thickness is decreasing as we go up here, and we measure as a function of temperature, you see these are all superconductors that have a decrease, you know, a lower critical temperature, and that's what I plotted on the previous, or what they plotted here, that was that decreasing critical temperature. That's these guys. But you reach a point, a critical film thickness, where all of a sudden it's no longer superconducting. And not only is it no longer superconducting, it's the resistivity isn't just coming in now at some metallic value, it looks like it's diverging. So this now represents a transition between a superconducting state and an insulating state. So no metal state in between. You don't need that anymore, which was very intriguing. There was also this quantum of resistance that showed up for bismuth, but actually when they did the same experiments in lead, it didn't. So how universal this is was cast in doubt. I think originally they thought there was something fundamental about this. So that's just thin films. Very related to those are so-called interfaces. So one of the things in condensed matter that is a good thing is we have this connection to engineering. And we're at the point where we can design our materials. So we don't just go, you know, it's not just going out in nature and finding materials or even mixing certain chemicals in a laboratory and coming out with a certain compound, but we're actually, you know, laying down, well, it's coming up in a couple of transparencies, but we're actually laying down layers, for example, in a very predefined manner. So there's this talk online, I guess it's still online, by Manhart, where these slides are taken from, and it's a fascinating area that only started about, I think it was a little more than 10 years ago, with a guy called Huang, who's a collaborator on this work. So you'll get these, you can form these 2D electron gases at interfaces. That's been known for a long, long time. And that was a subject of study, and you can do quantum Hall effect type measurements, and you get these plateaus and so on. But you can actually form these heterostructures. So this is lanthanum aluminum oxide. It's an insulator. Okay, it's stoichiometric, so it's what's called a band insulator, which is it's an insulator for the reason that the Fermi level lies in one of these gaps. And you can form strontium titanate, which if it's undoped is also an insulator. And so these are layer by layer they're forming, and then they come together at this interface, where if you just sort of look at what's happening here, you imagine you're forming lanthanum titanate. And so what happens if you put this band insulator up against another band insulator? What happens at the interface? Well, somewhat surprisingly, you end up getting a superconductor. And it seems to be a superconductor only along this interface. So it's like one of the ways of getting a truly two-dimensional superconductor. Okay, and as you know, this has been in the news on the theoretical side in the last few weeks because Kosterlitz and Thouless, who had a share of the Nobel Prize, got it largely for this work on the 2D transition to a superconducting state, which is called the Kosterlitz-Thouless transition. Okay, so here it is. Now, the critical temperatures, these are millikelvin, so these are tiny critical temperatures, but nonetheless, it's superconducting. The fact that it's superconducting because you've brought together two insulators is fascinating, and people are studying what exactly is going on in these materials. Carbon has also been in the news for a few decades now, first with this Buckminster fullerene. So there are these molecules that can be, this is C60, I guess, and it represents the third allotrope of carbon. So we're familiar with diamond, we're familiar with graphite, but now you can form solids that use these as building blocks. So these are the units, right? I don't know if I have a picture here. So they're units that form a solid that actually, in some cases at least, has a body-centered cubic structure as shown here. So they, each one of these molecules occupies the corner of a cube, and then there's one in the middle. Now, when you dope these, you get a superconductor. And this was a big deal around 1990. When people discovered it. The buckyballs themselves were only discovered in 1985, and this is what Croteau and Smalley and somebody else won the Nobel Prize for a few years later. But doping them, again, this is the same idea as down here. You're now liberating some electrons because potassium likes to give up its electrons. And you get a superconductor. And for many years, actually, this was viewed as a so-called conventional superconductor. If you go back to that table I showed you, all that stuff will be available online somewhere. What's it called?
PSI Wiki.
Yeah, so it'll be there afterwards. You'll see that this is categorized as possibly unconventional. Okay, and that's largely because of what happened more recently. So those were back 1990s. People discovered that you could get a superconductor out of an antiferromagnetic insulator parent state. So this now looks like the high temperature superconductors, and it seems very unusual. So you're doping, and that's what these red atoms are down here. And the temperature depends on the pressure, as is shown here. So there's phase diagrams, and I don't think I'll say more about these. Speaking of carbon, graphite was one of the allotropes. And again, as you probably know, in the mid-2000s, one group managed to achieve graphene, which is simply two-dimensional graphite. So one sheet of graphite. And this is one of the famous papers. And what everybody was so excited about was that, unlike what these guys call Schrodinger fermions, so these are just fermions with a parabolic band like this, h bar squared k squared over 2m, graphene has these so-called Dirac cones. Okay, and I don't know if you, you probably don't know that a guy called Wallace in 1947 calculated the band structure for graphene and realized there were these Dirac cones. So that's a highly relevant piece of work. That work was done at Chalk River Laboratories, which is, everybody know where Chalk River is? It's north of here, it's in Ontario. It's where a reactor was built during World War II for the purpose of supplying plutonium for the Manhattan Project. It ended up not supplying plutonium, and it went on to start Atomic Energy of Canada and produce nuclear reactors that we have in Ontario, for example, that produce energy. So they're power reactors. Now, Canadian reactors utilize heavy water as a moderator. Most reactors around the world use graphite as a moderator. So a moderator is something to slow the neutrons down. You won't get the reaction going unless you have the neutrons slowed down. And at some point, there were two options. And Fermi in Chicago decided to go with graphite. And the Canadian group that was mostly British people decided to go with heavy water. And it's that heavy water that was borrowed for more than a decade by the Snow Laboratory that allowed them to do their measurements that saw the neutrino oscillations and got them the Nobel Prize. But Wallace was a theorist at Chalk River Laboratories, and the reason he was doing this calculation was because graphite was being used by the rest of the world to moderate the reactors. And graphite is three-dimensional, it's too hard, so as a theorist, he did the next best thing, which was two-dimensional graphite, which is graphene, which turned out to be highly relevant for this discovery in 2004. So it's amazing how things get work. And the other, he ended up going to McGill, and that's where he retired and has died since. But the other big Canadian input here was Gordon Semenoff, who's at University of British Columbia in 1984, sort of realized this was important in graphene and did this important paper that led to, one of Duncan Haldane's papers that got him the Nobel Prize just a few weeks ago. Anyways, that's a different story. So there's a nice review article in 2009 on electronic properties of graphene, and you can see it here. It's got stuff there, and I pull stuff from there. So as far as graphene goes, what you can view it as are these two-dimensional sheets that can be rolled up into what are called nanotubes, or it can be rolled up ultimately into these buckyballs. So these are examples of almost the same thing. As I mentioned, there are these Dirac cones. So this is the band structure computed theoretically. And this is a measurement, a cyclotron measurement. So you apply a magnetic field, and there are these things called Shubnikov-Dehaas oscillations, and you can measure the effective mass. This is effective mass versus N, the doping away from this Dirac point. And you see that you get that, the prediction here is that M star goes like the square root of N, and that's what's fitted to this data here. So it really is there in graphene. And there's also something called Klein tunneling. This is something discovered in particle physics in the 1920s, that you could have very anomalous tunneling behavior for highly relativistic particles. Okay, but now this dispersion looks like the dispersion of a highly relativistic particle. I know it's just condensed matter, and these are all millielectron volt energy scales, but it's still a playground now for some of these relativistic ideas, and there have been calculations and measurements done along those lines. Oh, just to show you the impact of graphene. So I don't know if any of you are familiar with these tables you can get that tell you the number of, so this is just the guy, one of the guys who shared the Nobel Prize for this discovery. These are his citations over the years, and you can see something happened in 2004, 2005, because the citations took off. What I'm covering up here is the scale of those citations. And I took this data back in 2009, and it was just looked pretty incredible. But if you update it to 2013, you can see the scale now has gone to 14,000 citations per year. Like, I have just over 3,000 citations in my lifetime. This is 14,000 per year. And if you update it a bit further to, I think a month ago I did this, You can see the scale's gone up to 20,000. And actually, I just checked before this lecture, and this number that was at 11,000 is up beyond 14,000. And you can see the numbers of citations here are absolutely through the roof. So it's just incredible what impact graphene has had on the research community. And actually, if you check what's cited highly in physics, this one paper, this is not graphene. This is density functional theory that we'll learn about a bit later on. This one paper has over 50,000 citations. And it was only produced in 1996. So it's getting of the order of 7,000 citations per year. And that's density functional theory, and that's partly because this allows you to calculate those band structures that I was talking about fairly accurately. And it happens that this paper is of interest to chemists as well. So the chemistry community cites this paper a lot as well. Okay, so a few more words about high temperature superconductivity. This is the compound. So unlike the elemental compounds I've been talking about, these compounds are very complicated. Okay, it's not actually written out here, but it's yttrium, barium, copper, O. So I think it's yttrium, something like that. 1, 2, 3. So the unit cell, or it's a bit more than the unit cell, is shown here. And there are all sorts of things going on. What most of the community believes is that the only thing that matters in the end are these copper oxygen planes. So the red are the oxygen, and the coppers are these sort of orangey yellow balls, and they form this two-dimensional lattice here and here. So there happen to be two planes in this case. So after all is said and done, you need this structure to get a certain amount of electrons off of these planes. So these are referred to as hole-doped materials, just like the one I said over there. And it was Bednors and Müller who first discovered a compound which is similar to that one, except it was barium instead of strontium, and found this very bad superconducting transition. It starts to go down above 30 degrees and only reaches zero really at around 10 degrees. So they actually used the word possible in the title because they were very cautious. It was only, you know, so that paper was published in, I think, November of 1986. There was a meeting in November and then one in December where I think these guys heard about it. And then they quickly discovered that a different substitution would get you a 93-degree superconductor. And that's the transition temperature there. And since then, there's been a lot of work with a lot of compounds. Here's that same phase diagram that I showed you earlier, except now we've also added so-called electron doped. So people have discovered that you can form compounds where if you check the periodic table, what you're doing when you add a little bit of this X, so the cerium in all these cases, is you're doping with electrons. And almost the same thing happens. The superconducting is a lot less, and it you know, the way the phase diagram is drawn here, it looks like these two phases repel one another. They don't want anything to do with one another, whereas now it's clear that the superconducting phase snuggles up against the antiferromagnetic phase over here. So there's differences, and people have been studying this quite a bit. If you think about, this is the 93 degree Kelvin superconductor. And this thing over here was the 35 degree superconductor. And it, you can see just staring at the periodic table, and the original one was barium doped lanthanum cuprate. So when you stare at the periodic table, you see strontium, barium, lanthanum, and yttrium all in those four squares. So it wouldn't have taken a lot to just by looking at this to come up with this possibility, which is what those researchers did in Houston, Chu et al. By the way, I don't know if you're familiar, but this periodic table, you know, sometimes it's drawn so that these two rows actually come out of the board, like come out like this, because one of them, basically, if you go to the right here, you're worrying about the d electrons. If you're coming out, which is going down to these guys, you're worrying about the f electrons. You're filling up f electron shells. Okay, and there's pseudo gap behavior. A word on the theory, which we'll describe at the end of the course, but just in advance, you can calculate all these various properties, and when you form certain ratios, they actually become numbers. And this was one of the things, so BCS is Bardeen Cooper and Schrieffer. Actually, when I'm teaching my undergraduate classes, I always quiz them on how many of them know who John Bardeen is. And let me do the same quiz here. How many people here have heard of John Bardeen? So
he was essentially the person who found the whole condensed matter theory in the University of Illinois.
Yeah, yeah. So you were at the University of Illinois, so that's not fair. So there's about four or five of you total. Okay, now, and then I asked them, does anybody know who Albert Einstein was? And all the hands go up. And if I ask how many of you have heard of Richard Feynman, most of your hands would go up as well. Okay, but you should know about John Bardeen, because he's the only guy who's won two Nobel Prizes in physics. Right? These other lightweights like Einstein and Feynman only won one. Right, so Bardeen actually the work on superconductivity was delayed slightly because he had to rush off to Stockholm to collect his first Nobel Prize. There's a story behind that too, because I was sharing a van ride. So in 1989, there was a big high temperature superconductivity meeting at Stanford. And I flew in, and from the airport, I ended up sharing a van ride with John Bardeen and his wife. And I spoke to John Bardeen, who doesn't speak. Basically, you talk to him and he almost says nothing. So I was trying to talk to him because I was actually working on one of his theories at the time. But I was actually more interested in the conversation behind me, which was his wife speaking to a student from Stanford who turned out to be a journalist student. And it was hilarious to listen to this because, you know, they're just people coming to a conference and so on, and then, oh, did they come, where are they from? Urbana, did they come from Urbana? No, they flew up from Santa Barbara. Why'd they go to Santa Barbara? Because they were visiting. So she said, he was visiting Bob Schrieffer, who was at Santa Barbara at the time, and she mentioned that he had shared a Nobel Prize with him. And then I heard, you know, out comes the notebook and the student is starting to take notes now. And then comes the question that I was waiting for, is, oh, when did he win the Nobel Prize? And of course his wife had to answer, well, he won his first Nobel Prize in 1956. And then his second Nobel Prize was in 1972. So 1956 was when they were doing this work. And he had to leave and go to Stockholm to collect his first Nobel Prize, which was for the transistor, with Bardeen, Shockley, and Bratton. And if you think of one of the most important things in our lives these days. It's the transistor. And it's a theorist that shared a Nobel Prize in that. And the second Nobel Prize was for this work on superconductivity. So the reason why you haven't heard of him is because he wasn't flamboyant, he wasn't, you know, playing bongo drums in Brazil, didn't have hair that stuck out a mile away, and so on. But that's who BCS refers to, Bardeen, Cooper, and Schrieffer. And this work was published basically in 1957. And very important for a variety of reasons. But and one of the things that was really neat was this universality. They calculated that this is that gap I was referring to earlier. We'll learn more about it later. This is the critical temperature. That ratio comes out to be a constant. So what Bardeen, Cooper, and Schrieffer were predicting was that no matter what the material, all the material stuff cancels out here. No matter what the superconductor is, you're going to get this number 3.53. And same with the specific heat jump. So this universality was something that was very very inviting about this whole theory. But so it's wonderful, but it's also a curse. Because if it's a number, and you're supposed to get it no matter what the material is, then you can't hope to learn anything about the material by measuring this number. Now, as I don't know if we'll have time in the course to go on, but you can find deviations from this number for reasons having to do with why the material superconducts. So now, at least, if you measure those deviations, you can learn something about why the material superconducts. So universality is great, but as I say here, it's also a curse. And just to show you how accurate this theory was, aluminum is considered the prototypical conventional superconductor. The TC for aluminum is just over 1 degree Kelvin. Okay, so you can measure this gap through tunneling. I will say a little bit more about tunneling in a few slides, but the old style of tunneling was to actually make junctions. So these are layers of aluminum separated by a barrier, an insulating barrier, and now electrons will go around this circuit only if they can tunnel through here. And if they tunnel through, they actually give you a measure of this gap. That's what the theory said. So that's what these measurements are. They're measuring the tunneling characteristic as it's described for aluminum. Okay, if you didn't have this, if you just had something with a resistance here, a regular metal, you'd get Ohm's law, right? And that's so this is I versus V, and yeah, sure enough, when you go up to above the critical temperature of aluminum, you get Ohm's law. You just get a constant, not a constant, but you get a I is proportional to V, which is Ohm's law. But in the superconducting state, you're expected to see this gap. And if you plot that gap normalized to its zero temperature value versus temperature normalized to its TC value, BCS theory predicts this mean field-like curve. I'll tell you what mean field-like means in the course, but the data are these points, and you can see this spectacular agreement, which really showed that the theory was correct. This was verified a lot earlier than 1968, but this is Canadian work. Actually, Blackford was here at University of Waterloo, as far as I remember. Nowadays, we don't form those junctions. We use STM, so scanning tunneling microscopes. And this is there's a photograph of one, but the idea is that you've got this tip. You bring it up to a sample, and you tunnel electrons from the tip. And so you get highly directional information. And now the barrier, the role of the barrier is played by the small amount of air or vacuum between the tip and the sample. And you can make measurements like the ones previously, but I'm showing you here now. Another thing you can do with these is you can actually move atoms around. So when they first, so the scanning tunneling microscope was discovered in 1986, I think, and they won the Nobel Prize for that shortly thereafter. And then people at IBM started playing around and actually moving atoms on surfaces, first to give you figures like that. Then they would make a what was called a quantum coral. So these are iron atoms on cobalt. So they've actually moved the atoms to their position to form this coral in the first place. And then what they've observed, so they now use the scanning tunneling microscope as an observational tool, not as a tool to make these things. They observe these oscillations in the charge density. So this is the charge density on the surface of copper. And you know, these are supposed to be electrons, they're particles, they're even tunneling them, but they're observing this wave behavior, which is the point of this exercise. This is, I would claim, the most spectacular demonstration of this wave behavior. So this is a coral, but it's no longer a circle, it's an ellipse. And the ellipse has two focuses. And what they did in one of the focuses is they put a cobalt atom. Cobalt is magnetic. So that, I mean, the color is just the color enhancement, but this peak there is because there's a cobalt atom there, but it's right on the focus. And then they did the measurement over here. There is no cobalt atom here, but it's on the focus. And you know the properties of ellipses, like with sound even, that if you're standing there, everything will bounce off the walls here and become enhanced there. And so what they're seeing is an image of that cobalt atom over in the other focus, which is truly spectacular. And they could do, why did I lose that one? They could do these other things. This didn't come out so well. This is just a copper surface, and we're basically seeing atomic layers. But what you're really the attention is really being drawn to these undulations, and the ability to observe those undulations is amazing. Those are very weak undulations. They're from a surface mode in copper, and they occur because of defects. And there's something called Friedel oscillations, which again we'll learn about later in the course. But you can actually observe these. And the defect here, in this case, is just the surface itself for this step, but there's also defects in the sample as well. I'm almost out of time. Let me just say a word about Elie-Ashberg theory, but let me not get into that kind of detail. So Elie-Ashberg theory tells you it's a more detailed description of the superconducting state than BCS is, and it tells you about what the mechanism for attraction. I mean, after all, well, you don't know this yet, but to get electrons to form a superconducting condensate, what the theory claims is that electrons attract one another. And you can ask yourself, electrons don't attract one another. What do you mean they attract one another? And this is what the conventional theory says on how they attract one another. An electron in the vicinity of these positively charged ions polarizes them. So these ions move in to the dashed positions, and because the electron here has attracted them. But electrons are moving around very quickly compared to these ions. The ions are about a factor of 2,000 or more heavier, and so they're much more sluggish in comparison. So this electron zips in here, scatters out, And what's left behind? What's left behind are the ions in these dashed positions. That means that in this region of space, there is a concentration of positive charge. Because these are all positive, but they're all nicely spaced. But now, because of the presence of this first electron, these positively charged ions are slightly closer to one another in this region. So, and the electron is gone. Okay, I can't show it here, but I'll show it in the next view graph, or next slide. It means that once this electron is gone, this electron will be attracted to that positive region of space. Because that electron's out of there now. So you get this behavior, and I've sort of tried to make these always have opposite momenta, which is also a feature of the superconducting state. So if you just sort of blur your eyes and look at this whole thing from a distance, it looks like the first electron attracted the second electron, if you dismiss all the details. And it's also important to note that it attracted the second electron to where it used to be, not where it is now. So they're not attracting to one another now, because they are both negatively charged. But it's attracting it to where it used to be. So that's basically the idea. I was going to show some photo emission, but I think I'm going to skip this because of time. And I will come back to photo emission in one of the lectures. A word about the superconducting state, because this is what we will encounter later on. This is the hypothesized superconducting state. There are these pairs. So important to the state is a formation of what are called now Cooper pairs. Actually, some people call them Cooper-Ogg pairs for reasons I'll show you in a second. And one can also write this wave function in this fashion. So, I mean, interestingly enough, this wave function has an undetermined number of particles, right? We'll look at this again later on, but it has an undetermined number of particles. This wave function has a determined number of particles. This wave function has a definite phase, which is invisible right now, but this wave function integrates over all the phases. So there's that relationship between number and phase, and you get this this is Mexican hat potential, but again, that'll wait till later. I said it's all about pairs, and there's this limerick by George Gamow, and Ogg's theory was his intent that the current keep flowing 1 cent, so to save himself trouble, he put them in double, and instead of stopping, it went. So it sort of captures the essence of pairs. But most people I show this to, you know, lose track of what the message is, and they just say, who's Ogg? Because nobody's ever heard of Ogg. Ogg was a chemist in 1946, and he made this, this is like a one-column paper in Physical Review. He made this this compound, a metal ammonia solution, and I don't know what, basically he thought it had Bose condensed. How, I don't know. And how he figured out there were trapped electron pairs, I don't know either. So people repeated this experiment and found that there was no Bose condensation, so he'd done something faulty. But he, you know, he's sometimes attributed to be the first person who realized there was pairing involved in these experiments, but how he did that is not clear, certainly not clear from his paper. And it turned out not to be true in this case, so it's kind of a lucky stab in the dark. So I'm gonna skip over these things. Supersolid helium has been in the news over the last, it's a decade now, and there was the possibility that there was a super solid phase here. So this is a phase that's solid, yet it's got some superfluidity properties. And that's no longer thought to be true. So there was an article by the people who originally, actually Moses Chan originally wrote the paper purporting to see this, and he's a co-author of the retraction. His co-author in the original paper was Kim, but not this Kim. This is another student called Kim who also co-authored the retraction. So, but it's written in print that their first measurement is wasn't correct. And I could go on about topological superconductivity or topological insulators, but I'm going to refer to these lecture notes. I could do the same thing for cold atoms. That's another hot area in condensed matter. In particular, there's this BCS-BEC crossover, which I'll tell you more about towards the end of the course. So that was a very brief introduction to some of the things that are happening. There was a lot of superconductivity there. That's more a reflection of me than the field, I would say, because as I mentioned, right now topological insulators are the hot topic. Although integrated over the last 25 years is probably not a bad representation of what's gone on. So I'm going to stop here, and tomorrow we'll start with sort of some more. I have some other slides to show you, but they're more in the context of describing Bravais lattices, the reciprocal lattice. So we're going to start from square one more slowly tomorrow. And we're probably all hungry. So that's it for today.